Chapter 3, Second Story, Song of a Yogi's Joy. Here I have used David Snellgrove's translation, in which this episode is called Milarepa and the Novices. At the time I gave the seminar on which this chapter is based, this seemed to me the best version available. Chang's better-known version, in which this episode is called Song of a Yogi's Joy, had yet to appear. The opening section of Song of a Yogi's Joy brings us immediately into a remote, often terrifying, elemental world. Milarepa is in a high and isolated mountainous region on the sparsely inhabited border between Nepal and Tibet, and judging by the name given to his temporary residence, the Tiger Cave of Singhadzon, he has chosen to occupy a fearsome place of shelter. But it soon becomes apparent that this rather alarmingly named cave is not as unsuitable for meditation as it sounds. Milarepa finds its atmosphere peaceful and tranquil, and then he sees something or someone. He is visited by the radiantly beautiful figure of the local deity of Yolmo. Consequently, his meditation is calm and full of energy and joy. This visitation suggests that Milarepa has a vivid sense that the atmosphere of the place is fully in harmony with his meditative mood and spiritual aspirations. It's as though the atmosphere of the cave is entirely attuned to his purpose and ready to cooperate with his aspirations. Milarepa's attitude is simply to make the best use he can of this beneficial environment. Of course, this is very much in contrast to the atmosphere created by the demons of the previous chapter, and we can conclude that Milarepa's own mental state is quite different. As it happens, Milarepa is not to be allowed to continue to enjoy his meditative time in the tiger's cave undisturbed. Some other visitors are on the way. News evidently travelled fast, even in the remotest parts of medieval Tibet. And as a result, Milarepa is visited by a group of five novices, who comment on the perilous and isolated nature of the place, and speculate rather intelligently as to whether it will benefit his meditation. Incidentally, these novices are referred to as nuns in Chang's translation. Certainly, Tibetan Buddhist nuns are always technically novices, because women were not given full ordination in the Indo-Tibetan tradition, the original Buddhist order of nuns having died out within about a millennium of its inception. However, in this context, it seems more likely that the novices visiting Milarepa are male. Milarepa responds with his own impressions of his habitation, which has been chosen for him, it seems, by his teacher, and his observations come as a bit of a surprise. If we have had any kind of mental picture of this remote place up to now, it has been bleak, barren, and inhospitable. The tiger's cave offers nothing in the way of comfort and appears, even to the eye of medieval Tibetan trainee monks, who would be used to levels of hardship that we would not contemplate, eerie and dangerous. But Milarepa himself is full of praise for it. He talks in terms of colour and light, flowers and birdsong. There is even a suggestion of some human presence, or at least flowering meadows, even if they are so far from habitation that they are visited only rarely. The novice's impression of the place is an example of the way negative emotions get in the way of our appreciation of things and reduce our ability to see the world around us. They see the loneliness of the location and the almost unbroken solitude of Milarepa's existence, and this is what makes the place frightening to them. Being overpowered in this way by the sense of solitude, they don't see the beauty. This is a common reaction, of course. Some people find even the ordinary English countryside terrifying, seemingly happier to congregate in places where any disconcerting encounter with terror or beauty can safely be avoided. In places like art galleries, too, we are used to going around in a crowd, and some people are perhaps more comfortable with that than being left alone with all that beauty. But someone who is sufficiently absorbed in the collection will hardly notice the absence of other people in the gallery, and if they do notice, they will be only too happy to enjoy the art undisturbed. Milarepa's whole life is like this. He is not oppressed by solitude, he does not feel lonely, and he is therefore free to enjoy the natural beauty of his surroundings. He knows this place is lonely, but he is glad of it and doesn't experience the loneliness as a threat. One might say that Milarepa is in harmony with the local deities in a way that the novices are not. Where others experience loneliness and fear, Milarepa sees only beauty and joy. This is due to his attainment of what he calls the clear light of realization of the void. The void is shunyata, the Mahayana and Vajrayana term for ultimate reality. But why does he call it the clear light? Text. It is in such a lonely place as this that I, the yogin Milarepa, am joyous in the clear light of realization of the void, joyous exceedingly at its many ways of appearance, joyous at its greatness of variety. Milarepa's use of this expression, which is very common in the literature of the tradition, signals a clear parting of the ways between the Yogacara school of Buddhism and the rationalistic philosophizing of any tradition, referring as it does to the actual experience of the void, not to some abstract theoretical construct. But why clear light of the void? What kind of light is it? The voidness or emptiness of this realization is not null and void, but a state of utter freedom. It is intensely positive, beautiful, lucid, and bright, such that one can really compare it only to the purity and energy of brilliantly clear light. Of course, this is a metaphor. It is certainly not light as we commonly understand it. For one thing, ordinary light has a source, whereas the pure light of the void doesn't come from anywhere, and it doesn't go anywhere. Shunyata is free from any duality, such as subject and object, time and space, or even light and dark. When we think of something, we think of it as being this or that rather than this, and we naturally think of ultimate reality in the same way. Certainly, the expression clear light of the void suggests that we are to think of it as having the nature of light rather than darkness. But this is only a manner of speaking. In fact, reality cannot be fixed to or in any one thing or tied down in any way. Not, of course, that it is itself any kind of thing. The followers of the Yogacara were concerned to follow a progressive path. First, reduce all phenomena, all appearances, to the one mind. Then, realize that the one mind is perfectly void of any distinction between subject and object. For the Yogacara, mind is no more real, in an ultimate sense, than anything else. It is not any kind of universal substance from which everything ultimately derives. It must be seen to be void. There is mind, consciousness, awareness, completely pure, completely illuminated and bright. But within it, there is no absolutely existent subject and object, or even a notion of a self in the ordinary sense. Of course, it is almost impossible for us to see this, to leave behind the idea of duality, without seeing in its place some kind of unity, however subtle. This is why reality is sometimes referred to as not two or non-dual, thus avoiding the risk of a return to a fixed and final conception of what reality is like. To speak of the void is perhaps as near as we can come to a description of the yogi's state of complete openness and freedom. We cannot fix down a clear description of the void, because its nature is not to be a particular thing with a fixed identity. It is mobile, constantly changing, flowing, forever assuming different forms. Knowing the true nature of the void, we should not be surprised if it demonstrates its void nature by changing into something else. The enlightened mind does not try to pin reality down to any particular manifestation and insist on experiencing it only in that way. When you see things from this perspective, the very idea of the attainment of a goal becomes absurd, because the goal is ultimately to transcend the duality that is necessarily involved in the attainment of a goal. You let go of any sense that you are realizing some separable, distinguishable attainment that you didn't have before and that others do not have. On the contrary, you realize that you are unknowingly a Buddha from the very beginning. Like the beggar in a parable from the Lotus Sutra, Sadama Pundarika, who didn't realize that a priceless jewel had been sewn into the corner of his robe. You have not left the world of impurity behind, or come into possession of the pure realm of nirvana. Your own ordinary thought is confirmed in the Buddha state. The attainment is outside time, and when you come to it, you realize that you have been there all the time. So when you gain enlightenment, you realize that you always were enlightened. Your original possession has simply been confirmed. The absurdity of the situation is often, apparently, what first strikes the newly enlightened person. Hence the laughter that is so often reported in the Zen tradition as the natural reaction to the event. How ridiculous to think that one had ever been anything but enlightened. How silly to have suffered so much and so unnecessarily. Free from samsara, the round of mundane existence, you become free within samsara. You are able to return to the world of suffering without taking that world of distinctions for absolute reality. The laughter therefore also arises from intense relief. It is as though, having spent your whole life deeply anxious about something, you suddenly see the truth of the situation, which is that there was never anything to worry about. How absurd all that anxiety and struggle was, you say to yourself. What a fool I've been, thinking I was this, thinking I was that. I was just barking up the wrong tree. And at that point, you can afford to laugh. What a silly Buddha I was. Milarepa sings, joyous with a body free from harmful karma, joyous in confusion of diversity, joyous midst fearful appearances. Even that which appears confusing and fearful cannot extinguish Milarepa's joy. His assurance and confidence are not subject to external conditions. He feels no compulsion to impose any kind of logical order on the true nature of things. He doesn't insist on understanding the ultimate reality of things. He doesn't try to fit reality to any idea, even the idea of its variety. If its variety were suddenly to resolve itself back into a unity, he would be joyous in that too. Let reality be as it wishes. He doesn't hold on to it in any form. Let it be one, let it be many, let it be empty, let it be full. He doesn't mind. He remains joyous. He has no fixed ideas about reality, to which he insists that his experience of it should conform. He is joyous in the clear light of realization of the void. In his meditations too, though he may be visited by fearful apparitions of deities of various kinds, he sees them as just that, apparitions. All fear is ultimately fear of annihilation, and you gain courage by accepting that possibility, transcending the threatened self, and going beyond it to a new self, at which point the process starts again. Milarepa can no longer be fooled by any sense of annihilation, and now he experiences only a deep fulfillment where fear used to be. Milarepa's experience is not abstract or theoretical. His joy is rooted in bodily experience, the precious human body that Tibetan Buddhism traditionally prizes as the ideal vehicle for the attainment of enlightenment. So he takes joy in the blessing of, quote, a body free from harmful karma, of being able to meditate without hindrance in the form of bodily pain or weakness, not being dependent on the positive conditions he enjoys makes it easier for him not to take them for granted. Milarepa sings, joyous in my freedom from that state where distractions rise and pass away. The implication of this line is that with regard to distractions in meditation, there are three distinct states of mind. There is, first, the state of mind in which distractions are experienced as arising and just hanging around. They may be recognized as distractions or hindrances, but they are not considered impermanent, and they are therefore difficult to deal with decisively or effectively. Secondly, there is the state of mind in which a certain degree of understanding has arisen with regard to the impermanence of things. Distractions are experienced as transient, passing through the mind like clouds. Knowing that there is no need to turn an itch into a studied interest, you don't allow yourself to get involved in it, and the same goes for all distractions. Just because you feel an occasional hankering for certain worldly pleasures when you are on retreat, or for things in your day-to-day life that you have forsworn for a certain period, or even for life, you don't have to take such yearnings seriously. They are just momentary hindrances of craving or restlessness arising from previous conditioning. Both these states of mind call for vigilance and effort, but being enlightened, Milarepa does not need to deliberately redirect his mental and emotional energies towards enlightenment. It is at least questionable whether the fully enlightened mind will encounter distractions in the usual sense at all, because an enlightened person will be able to see potential distractions for what they are even as they arise, without falling under their spell. Milarepa, joyous exceedingly where hardship is great, joyous in freedom from sickness, joyous that suffering has turned to be joy. Milarepa clearly endures extreme physical hardship, cold, hunger, and so on, but note that he is joyous exceedingly in these circumstances. This is because it is in such adverse conditions that his joy shines out, as not being dependent on his circumstances. For Milarepa, even misfortune is a source of delight. He still experiences painful feelings of body and mind, but he finds joy in them because every misfortune becomes another opportunity to experience the unconditioned nature of his joy. Note also that he is joyous not that suffering has turned into joy, but that suffering has turned to be joy. That is, suffering and joy are not experienced as separate. He continues to experience the suffering, but the suffering is now joy. He's hungry. It's a joyful experience to be hungry. He's cold. It's a joyful experience to be cold. For Milarepa, every setback is a reminder of the impermanent, unpredictable nature of samsara and the sheer pointlessness of holding on to things and experiences as though the world were anything other than a product of mind. This is an aspect of the enlightened mind that it is important to get right. As long as it is associated with the physical body, there must always be the possibility, at least, of physical suffering, and even of the emotional suffering associated with life as a human being. But even though you suffer, whether the suffering is bodily pain or the emotional pain of losing someone close to you, your reaction to that pain and your experience of it will be entirely different from that of the unenlightened person. Milarepa. Joyous in the treasure of triumphant songs now uttered, joyous exceedingly at the sounds and signs of multitudinous syllables, joyous at their turning into groups of words. As an enlightened being, Milarepa enjoys the complete equanimity of his mind in all circumstances. He enjoys the pure creativity of its response. Whatever he experiences, his mind does not react by clinging to the experience or cutting off from it. His response is always one of further positivity, further skillful activity. Whether in songs or in other kinds of spontaneous expression, he enjoys the playful and inexhaustible manifestation of the enlightened mind. Like any hermit, Milarepa obviously relishes silence, but here he announces his enjoyment of singing and speaking. He enjoys watching the syllables coming out of his mouth and forming themselves into words and sentences. We can take it that his speech is not the expression of his ego, not self-expression as we understand it, but more like the chanting of mantras and puja recitation. It is the spontaneous expression of a non-dual state. After his initial paean to the joys of the yogi's way of life, Milarepa gives his visitors various teachings before concluding their meeting with a song that returns to his original theme of fear and the spiritual life. He begins the song by calling down the blessing of his teacher to help them come to firm knowledge, that is, irreversible insight. In the divine fortress of your own body. Chang, in his translation, makes this a more modest prayer for firm knowledge. But either way, the emphasis on the body is significant. Of course, one is most naturally fearful on behalf of the body, or if one is at all religious, for the state of one's soul or one's merit, which the body, far from protecting, is perceived to put at risk through sense cravings. The idea of the body as a fortress, therefore, challenges some deeply rooted assumptions. Milarepa is reminding us that firm knowledge can be attained only within the psychophysical organism, the precious human body. The body is indeed the citadel of awakening. Milarepa. Frightened by fears, I built up a castle, the voidness of absolute being. This was that castle, and of its destruction I now have no fear. The protection afforded by the voidness of absolute being is clearly not against the vicissitudes of life or even against feeling exposed to them. It will not replace the need to take appropriate steps to minimise the effects of life's misfortunes. But it does protect one's positive state from being affected by those misfortunes or dependent on the outcome of events. If, in its non-duality, Milarepa's joy is a transcendence of joy, it is also a transcendence of fear. There is no attachment to the experience of joy, and thus no fear of losing it. Fearlessness, or abhaya, is one of the fruits of spiritual practice, and its development is a particularly important aspect of Buddhism. It is linked to the traditional description of the ultimate objective as a refuge. A castle is the ultimate material refuge, the securest place possible. It is also the ultimate expression of fear and of the distinction we draw between self and other, us and them. The voidness of absolute being means the ultimate non-reality of the very distinction between subject and object, self and other, and it becomes a castle because it protects us against fear itself. Fear indicates attachment to the self in whatever way we conceive of it, and that in turn implies duality. We fear any threat to the self from what we perceive as not-self, as the other. As long as that distinction is perceived as absolute, we can never protect ourselves absolutely, and we will always be subject to fear. Milarepa goes on to consider the various kinds of ordinary human fear, making the way we assuage each of them into a symbol for some spiritual or transcendental quality or set of qualities. This quality, instead of temporarily assuaging the need that gives rise to fear, cuts across the whole cycle of dependency and thus removes the fear. For instance, Milarepa's protection against the cold is the warmth within, which is a reference to the practice of tummo, psychic heat, by which spiritual means you can generate actual bodily heat. Less literally, we could take the experience of cold as representing loneliness, the chill of emotional deprivation. The producing of warmth within then becomes contentment or emotional positivity, a radiance that comes not from some external source, but from one's own spiritual resources. It is a glow of inwardly generated well-being. As for the fear of poverty, this is overcome by means of the seven inexhaustible jewels. Traditionally, these are of gold, silver, crystal, ruby, coral, agate, and cornelian. Again, we can look for a symbolic meaning here. The Buddhist tradition has two well-known sets of seven jewels. There are the seven jewels of the Chakravarti Raja, the righteous or wheel-turning king, the elephant, the horse, the counsellor, the woman, the commander-in-chief, and so on. And there also is a list of seven positive mental events called the seven jewels. Either of these could be meant here. Milarepa is saying that by virtue of the spiritual qualities over which he has attained mastery, he has all the wealth in the world at his disposal. Far from being the impoverished beggar he appears to be, he is like a wheel-turning king, the world-governing monarch, whose laws and decrees are based not on tradition or selfish ambition, but on the Dharma. Material poverty holds no fear for him, because the wealth he values is not material, but springs from a renunciation of material wealth. The seven jewels can never be taken away from him by circumstances. As positive mental events, they are inexhaustible and endless. Inexhaustible, too, is the rapture and bliss of the concentrated mind attained through meditation. Milarepa: fearful of hunger, I sought for some food. absorption in the absolute. This was that food. And from hunger, I now have no fear. One is reminded here of the aspiration of a verse from the Dhammapada, quote, feeders on rapture shall we be. This is something that any regular meditator will be able to appreciate. Meditative absorption can be so tangibly and immediately beneficial that it is experienced as a sort of sustenance. Rapture, or in Pali, piti, Sanskrit, priti. Rapture is an inner nourishment that keeps the concentrated mind in a self-sufficient state of spiritual well-being. More generally, positive mental states, especially the state of mindful awareness, nourish the whole psychophysical organism. When attachment and aversion to things and experiences are abandoned, fear of hunger is nowhere to be found. Next in Milarepa's list of fears comes fear of thirst. This is the most frequent and immediately pressing of the physical appetites, and a powerful and seamless practice is needed to relieve the burden of fear associated with it, the nectar of mindfulness, as Milarepa calls it. Finally, Milarepa evokes the fear of losing one's way. Milarepa. Fearful of straying, I sought for a way. The practice of two in one, this was that way. And of straying, I now have no fear. The practice of two in one, which translates the term yuga nada, is a specifically tantric reference to the non-duality of wisdom and compassion at the highest level. Once you have accomplished this, you have at last achieved or embodied the middle way. Until that point, you have to keep asking yourself whether or not what you're doing is really the most skillful thing to be doing at that moment. Are you on the straight and narrow, or have you strayed a little off the path? Are you on the path of nirvana or the path of samsara? Are you making progress, or are you stuck in dry intellectual understanding, barren concentration of mind, or uninspired, if apparently skillful, activity? With the practice of non-duality, there is no distinction to be made between path and non-path. There is no right path or wrong path, and therefore no possibility of going astray. You no longer have to wonder if you are still on the right path. There is no path. The path is one of no longer following a path. There is no question of choosing between alternatives. By uniting wisdom and compassion in your own experience, you have also gone beyond the archetypes of the right and wrong paths, samsara and nirvana, the conditioned and the unconditioned. Milarepa's conclusion is that he is happy under any conditions whatsoever, and the next verse reveals the kind of conditions he has in mind. Milarepa. At Yolmo, in the tiger cave of Singadzon, one trembles with fear at the roar of the tigress, and this sends one involuntarily to strict seclusion. Towards the end of the song, Milarepa adopts a more obviously literary tone as he notes the sights and sounds of his solitary hermitage and the emotions that these evoke. Whether or not this elevated style is responsible for an element of ambiguity in the meaning is debatable, but Chang's translation transfers the trembling from Milarepa to the tigress, whose roar becomes a howling, a trembling cry. But it would seem quite possible that even Milarepa would tremble with fear, having placed himself in close proximity to a tigress and her cubs. It is important to remember that being fearless does not mean that you never feel fear. The point is that even while he doesn't suppress his natural human reactions, he is able to be happy in the experience of fear. It is as though he relishes the roar of the tigress. His fearlessness does not exclude the experience of fear. He actually enjoys the fear that, as an embodied being, he naturally feels. There is a kind of terror that is so invigorating as to be strangely pleasing. The proximity of danger makes you feel stronger, more courageous and heroic. Thus, trembling with fear can put heart into your practice and positively drive you to practice harder, with the awareness that whatever fearful experiences arise are finally no more than that, appearances, not fixed realities. You are the one element in the equation that can open up and release your tight hold upon objects, whether you crave them or fear them. Together with this seclusion from the world comes the arising of compassion, which Milarepa then, as he sings in the next verse, feels for the tiger cubs. This combination of withdrawal and compassion is very important in the teaching of the great founder of the Gelug school, Tsongkhapa. The withdrawal from the conditioned, accompanied by the arising of the bodhicitta, the will to enlightenment for the sake of all beings, produces enlightenment. It is not enough to withdraw. You must go out to the world in kindness as well. And conversely, it is not enough to be compassionate. The element of withdrawal is also needed. Milarepa. The cries of the monkeys cling to one's mind, and this causes involuntarily a feeling of sadness. But at the chattering of their young ones, one just wants to laugh, and this produces involuntarily an elevation of spirit. References to the cries of monkeys feature prominently in Chinese poetry, in which they are intended to convey an impression of touching melancholy associated with evening shadows and soft rain. To hear a monkey calling through the mist seems naturally to produce a sort of pleasing mournfulness. The haunting sound clings to the mind. Milarepa shares this common emotional reflex, and as with his natural reaction of fear, he does not suppress it. But he doesn't wallow in it either. He doesn't allow his mind to drift from this keen responsiveness to the sadness of the world around him into a self-regarding melancholia. His solitary situation is one in which loneliness can quite easily turn into depression. And here he shows us how to work creatively with the moods that we might experience on solitary retreat, directing this initial response of sadness towards a broader appreciation of the situation in which we find ourselves. Attending to the comical chattering of the young monkeys, his initial reflectiveness turns into happy laughter, bringing an access of energy and an elevation of spirit. This positive result of a simple but creative shift of attention suggests the beginning of the spiralling process outlined in the traditional formulation of the Bodhiyangas, the seven factors of enlightenment. The upward spiral begins with mindfulness, continues with investigation of mental states, energy, joy, and so on, and culminates in an exalted state of insight and equanimity. Milarepa. Sweet to the ear is the sad song of a cuckoo with its tremulous note, and one is caused to hearken involuntarily. And the varied cries of the raven are cheering to his neighbour the yogin. Happy is the state of one who lives in such a spot as this, without the presence of a single companion, and even in this one is happy. And now, by the song of this rejoicing yogin, may the sufferings of all beings be removed. Milarepa's attitude is never self-referential in the narrow sense. His equanimity is a state of mind free from fixed views, from one-sided reactions, both to external physical events and to emotional or mental events. He does not see or feel things from just his own point of view. He is always able to take in the whole situation. His awareness is thus essentially appreciative in tone. The colour and vibrancy of these verses illustrate the fact that Milarepa's poetic sensibility is attuned to beauty wherever and whenever it may be discerned. His freedom from partial, self-referential, fixed views means also that he is not ascetic in the traditional sense of refusing to take pleasure in things. Nonetheless, this is more than just aesthetic appreciation. It is a practice, even if in Milarepa's case it has been perfected and is second nature. Whatever emotions arise, he shifts effortlessly in a continually more positive direction. He turns to good account all those lonely sights and sounds that could be, if one allowed, distracting or even dispiriting. The fact that this elevation of mind is involuntary is characteristic of Milarepa's sublime mental state. The perceiving mind is, after all, impermanent, and for Milarepa, impermanence is a source of delight. If your experience of yourself is not separateness, but the blissful void, you have transcended the duality of self and other, and that is the ultimate basis for loneliness. You are no longer an ego, and therefore no longer distinct from other egos. How can you feel lonely if you don't experience the ultimate reality of yourself, even when absolutely alone, as separate from others? What this closing section conveys is a sense that the world around Milarepa supports him in his practice. It does so because his practice is ultimately concerned with that world. He expects to be uplifted by the cries of the raven because he feels he is the raven's neighbour. He sees himself as sharing the place where he lives with the wild natural forms, both animals and spirits, that have always occupied it and will continue to do so when he has moved on. So it is not that Milarepa is happy despite his isolation. He is happy in it. He isn't trying to hang on to his joy. In fact, he is letting go of it. He isn't doing his best to be positive in a challenging situation. He actually sees his situation in positive terms. He is happy that he is without a single companion, even as he offers up his happiness to the welfare of all beings. In his remote mountain hermitage, Milarepa renounces attachment to human community, to property, to any sense of separate self. And he does this not for the sake of a miserable, deprived existence, but the more fully to enjoy the freedom and the blissfully clear light of the void.